Hello, welcome to Foreign Entanglements. I'm Matt Duss of the Center for American Progress, here with my partner in Foreign Entanglements, Rob Farley of the University of Kentucky. How are you today, Rob?
Doing fine. How are you?
Pretty good. So last weekend, I think it was Friday night or early Saturday morning, the news broke that Mitt Romney had selected Paul Ryan, congressman from Wisconsin, as his vice presidential running mate. Interestingly, pleasantly, amazing me that Republicans have not yet learned one of the central truths of American politics, which is never, ever listen to Bill Kristol. So I wonder if it takes another round of this for them to learn that, but maybe not.
Right. I mean, Kristol is sort of fascinating for having, and as far as I understand, for not yet. I mean, well, Kristol can't apologize, right? It's his whole thing. And he can't admit that he's wrong. That's also part of his whole thing, right? Everything would collapse if he tried to do that. Ryan certainly seems more competent on a series of levels than the previous Republican vice presidential nominee, right? I mean, he can, in the English language, string sentences together that make sense. And he's sort of rightly observed to be at least an intellectual center within the House of Representatives, mm-hmm. With regards to a particular vision of what American government ought to look like. What's sort of fascinating, it's fascinating coming from Kristol, certainly, and I guess I have my own thoughts on this, is that for somebody like Kristol who focuses mainly on foreign policy, that Ryan has very little foreign policy cred, right? He doesn't mm-hmm. have, there is not much to his foreign policy background, which is fascinating because, of course, there's not much to Governor Romney's foreign policy background mm-hmm. either, right?
Right.
He was governor of a state that is not tiny, at least in population terms, and that does have sort of substantial international connections, but at the same time, he's not known for being a foreign policy visionary even mm-hmm. in the way that some other governors might be. And so there's no balance to the ticket. There simply seems to be a concession that they're going to run a very simple series of messages on foreign policy, and that none of those mm-hmm. messages are going to involve we are the more experienced team or we have any sort of foreign policy credit to our side.
Right. No, I thought it was interesting that Eli Lake at the Daily Beast Newsweek, rushed out a piece speaking to a number of neoconservatives who were all like, "Oh, we're all fine with this. Mm-hmm. It's all this is all good." I think at the very least, it indicates that yes, foreign policy is not going to be at the top of their agenda. I don't think that's a big surprise, but I think it also confirmed a lot that it's the national security arguments, such as they are going to be farmed out to outside groups. Like the SEAL Swift Boat group, who we'll get to later.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that Eli's comments are pretty interesting. Could it be argued? An argument that I've been making for a while, and I think that you probably agree with, is that this whole constellation of right wing think tanks, and especially right wing foreign policy oriented think tanks, and so Heritage, AEI, so forth. Mm-hmm. Has been utterly captured by the neoconservative wing of the Republican foreign policy establishment to the extent mm-hmm. that they've waged what is effectively a battle of annihilation against the realist wing, right? Mm-hmm. The realists are dead, they are exiled, they are they have no significant, meaningful influence on the elite circles of Republican foreign policy at that time, or at this time. And so to the extent that candidates like Ryan and Romney have no significant foreign policy personalities of their own and no significant foreign policy views of their own, they are forced to sort of adopt ready-made arguments from places like the Heritage Foundation, from places mm-hmm. like AEI, which is why Bill Kristol thinks that they're perfect, right? Because mm-hmm. because that essentially gives all the levers over foreign policy to the places that the neoconservatives already control.
I see what you're saying. I do disagree a little bit that there is no... I think clearly the neoconservatives have, they have taken and continue to hold the commanding heights of Republican conservative establishment foreign policy making. I don't think there's any question. But I think there is still a presence... there's still a realist presence. You have people like Stephen Hadley. You have people... You have this whole, the kerfuffle last week with... I just completely blanked
Zolik.
On his name. Zolik, yeah, Robert Zolik. you know, being brought on it, as part of the Romney transition team, and, you know, people, you know, Jennifer Rubin, you know, eliciting, I think, what were some of the greatest blog posts Dan Dresner's ever written.
Was it something like, if you copy and paste directly from the PR statement, at least try to click the Wikipedia link or something along those lines?
Right. I mean, talk about going Hulk. I think after Dresner wrote that post, he woke up in a strange place and ripped purple jeans somewhere. No, I mean, so that, you know, that was seen as a threat, clearly, to the neoconservatives, and I think it gets to, you know, there is still a presence, there is still, you know, we can get to in a minute, I think there's real discord. There's a genuine argument going on right now among certain sectors of the conservative movement on foreign policy, but there's still a presence of realists. They're clearly, you know, on the defensive.
Right.
But I think what's more interesting is that there's really no one coming up. They are not reproducing.
Right.
That's
right.
The kind of interesting thing about the realists in the conservative establishment. It's like, who's the next Stephen Hadley? Who's the next Republican Brent Scowcroft? You just cannot find one.
Right, right, and going through, because I had opportunity to go through sort of Romney's China team, Romney's East Asia team, and it was interesting in terms, there was a reasonable amount of diversity to it, sort of reflecting what you would imagine to be the diversity of the Republican coalition on the issue of the People's Republic of China, right? And, you know, that diversity should be obvious, right? There should be sort of hawkish neoconservatives who are sort of deeply skeptical of China's ability to play a role in the international system. At the same time, there should be commercially oriented Republicans who are utterly aghast at the notion that we might try to disrupt the extremely lucrative and productive economic relationship that currently exists between China and the United States. And Romney's team, I think you're right, does reflect some of that, although we hear much more from the neoconservative side. The neoconservative side is much more vocal, I guess, is much more capable of acting as an echo chamber than the other side.
Oh, absolutely.
But that, I mean, isn't that, I mean, isn't that, I mean, is that a sign of conflict, that there genuinely is struggle going on within the Romney team, or is that just the sound of victory, right? Are those the bells of neoconservative victory tolling that they can so successfully launch an attack on someone who, from a Republican point of view, should be as uncontroversial as Bob Zelig?
I would see it as more. I would see it as genuine concern. But I do, you know, I think it goes to the point that the fact that he thought it beneficial as far as, like, tending to his, you know, the various interested constituencies within the establishment, and this goes to his, you know, the people he's brought on as advisors, which, as you said, you know, there's some diversity there. It leans heavily neocon. But, you know, he still feels the need, and his advisors still feel the need to reach out and kind of, you know, satisfy those constituencies. They are still a presence. They've not been completely wiped out. You still need to check that box.
Right.
And I'm not sure how long that will continue to be the case, because, as I said, I mean, just who are the inheritors of this legacy within the conservative establishment? I don't see any.
Right, and it's interesting to see what, or to think through what a 2016... I think everybody is sort of, or at least by everybody, I mean me, is sort of fascinated by what Republican politics will look like for the next 4 years if Obama wins re-election. And especially sort of the arguments that will be made in 2016 regarding, whether, you know, in spite of the nomination of Paul Ryan, whether, essentially the narrative will become that once again Republicans ran a moderate and that moderate was defeated, and so therefore we can never again run moderates. And I don't. I'm almost certain that if Romney is defeated, that narrative will emerge. I'm not sure how that narrative will play out in foreign policy terms, especially if Romney sort of wholesale adopts this sort of neoconservative vision of what his foreign policy ought to look like. Even if he doesn't make that really a centerpiece of the campaign, even if he sort of leaves that. Essentially just checks that particular box. But.
Well, I mean, that's the kind of beauty of the neoconservative argument, is it can never be disproved. I mean, I think that's true of the actual policy in, say, in the Middle East as much as it is with regard to campaigning on the policy. You just didn't support freedom enough. You know, it wasn't that our ideas for doing that weren't wrong and crazy. It was just that we didn't do it hard enough. Right?
Right, right, right. I mean, there are. I am. The comments there immediately draw me back to several scenes in Apocalypse Now. Right. I don't see any method at all, but which is so appropriate for this conversation for so many different reasons. So let's. On what is essentially the same, was on certainly a connected topic. There's a lot of conversation out right now about, again, an Israeli attack on Iran, and you know we have, and I you know hate to pick too much on him, but we have Jeffrey Goldberg sort of breathlessly talking about how all of his Israeli sources are saying that an attack is imminent. I'm sure it'll happen in just months, but you know at some point that might actually happen, right? Even though you know it's fairly obvious that the Israelis have been lying about how imminent an attack is since I don't know like 2005. It still seems like they can say it'll be in the next 18 months, or the next 18 months, will the next three Friedman units will be absolutely critical. But, you know, then it actually is possible that at some point that may be true, right?
Right.
And so maybe this time they're not actually lying to Jeff Goldberg when they say that it's going to happen right now. What do you think is going to happen? I mean, what's going on right now with the recent very hawkish statements coming out of Israel about Iran, and how does that play with the presidential campaign?
Well, there's two things. I think, well, there's more than two, but, you know, I think, I was in Israel just a few weeks ago. I had a number of meetings with current NX officials in the defense establishment, and, I mean, part of it is just that the Israelis, you know, the current Israeli government really feels that Iran has not been sufficiently convinced that an attack is imminent. Their feeling, and I've seen this echoed by some people I also trust here in the U.S., is that Iran is really not afraid of an Israeli strike. They think an Israeli strike at its best would, you know, just cause limited damage while at the same time freeing Iran, you know, just releasing Iran from international pressure as the international community focused on Israel. What are you doing, Israel? So, I mean, it's not an intention, but it's a capability question with Israel, where it's the reverse with the United States. Iran understands that the United States could cause substantial damage to its country and to its nuclear program, but sees President Obama, I think, correctly, as someone who's just not into this.
And
so part of it is this just trying to create some sense of fear on Iran's part. And part of it is also it's just focused on the U.S. and the international community. And I think that they feel, and I don't know that they're entirely incorrect in this, that these statements over the past years about how we're close to striking, we're going to make a decision, the decision is imminent, has been one of the things that has spurred the U.S. and the international community to move with more speed and more aggressiveness on the pressure track.
Right, and I think you're right. That seems to have worked. I mean, is there ever... So say that we get to, you know, the day after the election in November, and Obama has won, and whatever is at in trade right now is 58%, which is probably about right, but we shouldn't, you know, take that as a foregone conclusion. But let's say that Obama has won. I mean, is there a way that this Israeli strategy backfires at some point, right? I mean, eventually does a victorious Obama just say, you know, go to hell, right? I mean, this was not something that I needed during this campaign. I mean, he's never actually going to say something like that. But is there a point at which it no longer amps up pressure on Iran and it simply starts backfiring? Or is this a strategy? Is there concern that this strategy could stop working at some point?
No, I think the concern is more that Bibi just paints himself into a corner and, you know, creates this momentum. And sure, I mean, we can all point out, and it's true that Israelis have been saying things like this for a long time. They've been saying the Iranians are just around the corner from a bomb for a long time. But at some point, when you use the sort of existential threat language that Netanyahu has been doing, you know, it's 1938 or, you know, whatever he's said. You know, at some point, if years and years and years go by and it's, you know, still that time and you haven't done anything, then people very reasonably start to say, well, maybe you're not being completely truthful. So, I mean, I see it as, and people I spoke to in Israel are very confident that, yes, Bibi actually believes, you know, it's not to say there's nothing political about what he's doing, because, yes, it's quite true that, you know, that there was a lot of you know, ferment in Israel on economic issues, and whenever economic issues, domestic issues are the main, what people are paying attention to, Bibi does very poorly. Mm-hmm. And when people are talking about how horrible Iran is, Bibi fares better in polls. But that said, you know, I think he's being truthful. He sees this as a real threat and possibly the single, you know, the central agenda item of his prime ministership.
Right. Now, when we say there's a potential that he could, I mean, to what extent is there any kind of developing? Because, and from reading Think Progress stuff, there seems to be a considerable amount of criticism of the notion that Iran right now poses an existential threat. Mm-hmm. But does any of that sort of have purchase in Israel, right? Or does the Iran question always redound to the favor of Bibi and sort of other hardliners? Is there any point at which at which that will stop working in a domestic political sense?
I have to say I'm really not sure, but I do think, you know, somewhere down the road, I'm not sure how long from now, months, years, that combined with other things could kind of create real problems for Netanyahu. I mean, I will say that the level of criticism, both private and public, coming from the defense establishment toward Netanyahu and Barak over the way they framed the Iran issue, as one veteran observer, you know, of the scene put it to me, he's like, I've never seen anything like this since the invasion of Lebanon. Mm-hmm. Just everyone coming out and saying, this is just, stop this. This is crazy. This is not good for us the way you are doing this. And we had Netanyahu, what I thought was kind of significant a couple of weeks ago, you know, declaring himself unafraid of the post-strike commission, you know, referring to the Winograd Commission after mm-hmm, the right. Lebanon war, the sense being that so many of these defense chiefs wanted to kind of go on record with their objections beforehand to say, we didn't want to do this, just right. in case, you know. And Netanyahu was like, sure, okay, I'm ready for this commission, let's do it. And that doesn't really communicate confidence to me.
How does, and we didn't talk about this before, but it's, I think it's relevant, how does the current situation in Syria, I guess, so two ways to think about this. One, how does the current situation in Syria play into the Israel-Iran dynamic that then plays into the election? Mm-hmm. And two, to what extent does the current situation in Syria have any implications, any independent implications, for what's going on in the U.S. election right now? I mean, Romney Ryan have not formulated any sort of precise. In fact, very few people have formulated any sort of precise plan, other than Max Boot, give them weapons or something, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But we've had very little in terms of specific.
Wait. You're saying Max Boot wanted more weapons and more.
Listen, it may in fact be true that Max Boot sometimes said something like that about some country, and you know, maybe
that's
I'm
crazy.
Just yeah. What do you want me to tell you? Anyway. So what do you think in terms of Syria's independent effect and then Syria's effect mediated through the Iran-Israel question?
Well, getting to the second first, I mean, mm-hmm. I think there's, firm belief both in Israel and I think here in the United States that the loss of the Assad regime would just in and of itself be a major blow to Iran. Even some people in Israel saying that could be the blow that actually causes Iran to change its calculus about how much a nuclear weapon is worth. Now, I think there's a reasonable argument to be made that the loss of such an important ally increases the value of a nuclear deterrent.
I was going to say, I agree with the second rather than the first. The North Korean experience sort of is one that occurs to me. The loss of the USSR made nuclear weapons radically more valuable to the same thing happened with the People's Republic of China, right? The loss of the USSR made nuclear weapons more valuable to the isolated state. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
Right, but it does go to this way of thinking that it's like more pressure, the more you isolate them, the more you frighten them, mm-hmm. it will make them do what we want, and I just haven't seen much evidence that's the case. There's no question that the loss of Assad would be, I think, a major blow to Iran, but how they react to that and how that changes their thinking, I think there's, you know, a legitimate argument.
It would substantially limit their ability to support Hezbollah, right? I mean, that's
right.
Sort of one of the big
right.
takeaways,
absolutely.
Which is certainly, you know, part of Iran's broader strategy of deterrence
mm-hmm.
against Israel is having Hezbollah and Hamas right there.
Right.
Right. No.
No, and some of the planning that's going on that I'd heard about, some of the plan, the possible, you know, just, you know, of course, Israel, like the United States, like any military, has contingency plans for
mm-hmm.
all kinds of things. You know, but some of the plans I'd heard.
Listen, we may still have to go to war against Canada, and it's important that we see Vancouver.
I've always thought that they're just waiting.
Yeah.
So, don't really want to take my honor. And, you know, the question, of course, is, okay, yes, the loss of Assad would be devastating for Iran and good in the long run for Israel, but what comes in the middle there?
Right.
You know, that's kind of the question across the region.
Right.
Sure, in the long run, more representative governments could be good, although I don't want to misrepresent that. I think that's kind of a minority view in the Israeli establishment,
right.
unfortunately.
Which
is also, I mean, which reminds me of something I wanted to get into about kind of the tensions within neoconservatism, pro-democracy versus Arab Spring is bad.
Right.
But we can swing back to that, maybe.
Right.
But no, the question is, okay, yes, the loss of Assad would be bad for Iran, good for Israel, but, you know, the chaos that comes in there, who comes to power, whether it's, you know, extremist Sunnis affiliated with al-Qaeda, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
These are serious concerns. Now, as for what Syria in itself, yeah, it's like nobody has any good ideas of how to kind of accelerate toward a positive outcome. You see the usual neoconservative claims for, you know, the U.S. needs to do more, the U.S. needs to lead, but then it kind of trails off into how what that actually looks like and how we affect the outcomes that we want.
Right, right. Right, and you know, I suppose that... as the situation, or if the situation, and right now it seems like an as the situation, but it could be an if the situation, as the situation deteriorates, as it becomes more bloody, as, you know, to the extent that the regime has any gloves, it can again take off, or it can continue to take off, there are opportunities for sound bites here, right? There are opportunities
mm-hmm.
for Republican sound bites, and so you
mm-hmm.
can see, you know, Romney fielding a question like this, or Ryan fielding a question like this sometime during debate, you know, well, what would you do with Syria? And, you know, Romney giving sort of the straightforward Max Boot answer. Well, you know, the president has failed by being insufficiently supportive
mm-hmm.
of the Syrian opposition, and we're allowing extremism,
mm-hmm.
blah, 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 blah. You know, I think we could also see sort of the frame of a Obama response, which would be that the governor is demonstrating his clear lack of command of international issues and
mm-hmm.
so forth, right? And, you know, I don't
mm-hmm.
know who wins that kind of exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that exchange, I suppose, that that exchange becomes very meaningful in terms of the actual election.
Right. I think that's the, unfortunately, that's right. I don't think that arguing for more intervention or doing more, spending more diplomatic capital, what have you, on the Syria issue,
mm-hmm.
as tragic as it is, and it is hugely tragic,
mm-hmm.
Is a political winner right now.
Right. Well, I mean, do you see at some point, is Obama going to be too nervous, is made too nervous by sort of the current political situation in Egypt to make a series of claims like, you know, when I became president, Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt were all dictatorships, and now they're all democracies. Is that too much for Obama to come out and say?
I think so. I think it was, you know, something of a lift for him for that May speech of last year to come out and, you know, come out and say what he did, you know, kind of frame the you know, the events of the Arab Awakening, saying, you know, now, yes, it's in our interest to really kind of push along this democratic reform, even though I think that's true,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's something that progressives should support and should continue to support.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, kind of where he places that in the kind of constellation of issues that he's really super concerned about and is going to commit
mm-hmm.
resources to in any real way, I'm not sure it's high up there. I mean,
mm-hmm.
there's also the question of, like, okay, what can you actually do?
Right.
You know, as we've seen, you know, the administration, I think, working pretty diligently to kind of form new relationships and do what we can to, you know, use leverage here and there. And, you know, these situations are going to develop as they will.
Right. Right, right. That I mean, every time I see some tweet or something that says, "Well, the United States propped up Mubarak for 30 years," it's like, yes and no, right? I mean, there are ways of talking about obviously the Mubarak regime and you know the predecessor regimes and so forth. That, and I think Americans, sort of both of the right and the left, are apt to vastly overstate America's influence in any kind of. Whenever we're describing events in countries like Egypt and countries mm-hmm. like everywhere else. I mean, still, there is an account, right, of, you know, around Libya, right? You can make, there's certainly an argument that, you know, depending on how limited Obama would want to make it, there's an argument that, hey, look, this was a real success mm-hmm. of our administration. And, you know, there are problems yeah. in Libya, but you have what is essentially the development of a representative government, and this wouldn't have happened if mm-hmm. I had made these decisions that Paul Ryan thought were a terrible idea, blah, blah, blah.
I think that's a good point, and it gets to where I think the Obama administration can make a significant, you know, an argument for some of their mm-hmm. foreign policy successes, and they really, I'm surprised at the way they haven't done. And maybe this gets to the idea of what kind of arguments are easily described and digested in an American election. It's just, you know, embedding American power within international institutions, once again, acting within a greater sense of international legitimacy. And I think Libya is a great example of that. I think the Iran policy is a great example of that. I simply don't agree with people who say that Obama's just kind of followed the Bush policy on Iran. No. The outreach to Iran at the outset of his presidency, the Nowruz messages, the letters to the Supreme Leader Khamenei, the efforts to really show good faith that the United States is really willing to come to the table and deal with these issues made an enormous difference mm-hmm. to the international coalition that was able to be forged and continues to work to pressure Iran. Now, of course, we can, you know, we haven't reached a deal. It's the question remains whether Iran will make serious changes in its nuclear work. But the fact of the matter is, the reason we were able to bring such international consensus to bear is because we changed direction.
Right. Right. I mean, well, there are two major differences, right? The first is what you mentioned, and it leads into the second, which is a considerably greater degree of international isolation for Iran. That mm-hmm. you know, to the extent you consider mm-hmm. that to be a good thing, mm-hmm. the Obama administration has certainly been more capable of enforcing that policy than the Bush administration had mm-hmm. been. Right? You know, one, because it's not as distracted, not nearly as distracted as by the situation in Iraq and so forth. Why don't we let's I'm happy to because I want to talk about the Navy SEALs a little bit, but let's pivot back to this question of neoconservatives in the Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. And what is the state of the art of neoconservative thinking on the progress of the Arab Spring? I know you pay more attention to this kind of thing than I do.
Sad but true. No, I think that it gets to a really interesting division that cropped up you know, fairly soon after the you know, the Arab Awakening started, the various uprisings and protest movements between, you know, genuinely pro-democracy neoconservatives like Robert Kagan. Mm-hmm. I would say Elliot Abrams is in there. Mm-hmm.
Our friend Eli is part of that side, right?
I put Eli in there. Mm-hmm. No, again, people who, you know, I have people with whom I have, and you have serious disagreements, but I think, mm-hmm. you know, at least we recognize that, you know, this they're serious about supporting democracy. We would disagree on the policies that they would undertake to promote it. Mm-hmm. But then you have neocons like Daniel Pipes, Frank Gaffney, and others who clearly are just completely skeptical of the ability of Arabs to do democracy. They're saying, oh, any democracy means the Muslim Brotherhood. We should, you know, and going so far as to say, you know, that the Obama administration is secretly working behind the scenes to promote the Muslim Brotherhood, as Frank Gaffney has said, mm-hmm. interestingly resulting in a mob throwing shoes at Secretary of State Clinton's car in Egypt because they had been inspired by Frank Gaffney's nonsense. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would say that the pro-democracy neocons are kind of the more serious ones, but I don't think this is a real tension within that movement. Mm-hmm.
Right, and you know, it's strange because it seems very difficult to, you know, other than sort of attacking the democratic bona fides of the movement, it's hard for me to see a way to exploit that kind of tension, right? If you're sort of outside the movement, especially if you were sort of if you had some sort of political interest in exploiting that. I mean, certainly you can always make fun of Frank Gaffney, and that's a lot of fun.
I think it's every American's duty.
It's every American's duty. Well, until the EMP hits, right? Until the EMP hits, yeah. And I have to eat my children, which...
Well,
you know,
after the EMP, no one will be able to call me out on the Internet about
that's
that.
That's right. So. The Internet, it'll be gone, right?
That's
and
right.
And Frank Gaffney, I'm going to come and eat your children after the EMP, right? I mean, why not? So obviously what we were referring to there was electromagnetic pulse, which is a serious concern,
right.
Or at least that's what James Gerhardt
tells us. A special hobby of Rob's and mine.
Yes.
And we should throw in a mention of your definitive piece on EMP, which we can include a link to. Oh, by the way, happy EMP Day, which was yesterday.
Oh, was EMP Day yesterday? And it passed
yes,
once
it was
again
yesterday.
Without an EMP attack. That's really disappointing.
I know. But me and the kids sat around. We made some beautiful tinfoil hats.
Mm-hmm. I mean, hopefully you had candles, right? You did have candles there. Just
of course, candles, yeah. Food straight out of cans, mm-hmm. some refried beans. Really just wonderful. Everyone, just a really great holiday.
Miriam, this is how you gut the cat if you need to. do this just
but no,
for
I
fun.
Mean, just to kind of tie this conversation up, no, I mean, getting back to the tension within the neoconservative camp, I think mm-hmm. there was an effort, and there still is an effort to kind of characterize neoconservatism as just, you know, as kind of pro-democracy as a defining feature of neoconservatism, and I think that's just wrong. I think
right.
what they share is a strong belief in the ability of U.S. military power to create outcomes anywhere. I mean, that is what the belief that all of these guys share.
Yeah, we should do one of these at some point about the release of the Team B report, which is out there, and we should do one of these. Just sort
oh,
of
the Sharia Team B report?
No. The older Team
the
B
old
report
one.
That was fully
yeah.
released and was out there. So anyway, also talking about blasts from the past, and we said we were going to talk about this. So there appears, and this movement has sort of been in the footing since for at least a year. What people are calling a swift boat maneuver to essentially sort of eliminate any responsibility that the President of the United States may have had for ordering a military operation to kill Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a variety of Republican operatives are part of this. They have connections with sort of legitimate and less legitimate connections with actual mm-hmm. special forces operators.
Mm-hmm.
And the point seems to be to argue that the Obama administration ought to gain no political benefit whatsoever from the death of Osama bin Laden, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, as if he sort of tripped
right.
on a rock or something like that. And so, I mean, I guess, first, do you think that the swift boating was actually as big of a deal as we remember for Kerry? And, you know, do you think this is going to be a big deal? Or what are your thoughts?
I'm hard-pressed to say how effective it was in actually, you know, damaging Kerry. I think it was effective in just kind of bringing... I mean, it was shocking that the extent to which those guys went after one of Kerry's strengths, which was that he was a Vietnam veteran who had been wounded. I mean, you remember those pictures from the GOP convention that year of people with little Purple Heart Band-Aids.
Right. It was disgraceful. I mean, it was as disgraceful. Yeah, as anything. Right. That a decorated military veteran should be mocked for his service.
Right.
And yet
exactly.
It was completely okay. It was completely okay
right.
by people who yeah.
So I think that's how I remember the significance there. I'm not sure who it convinced. I'm not sure who was like, oh, wait a minute, who was voting him for, primarily on the basis of his previous service. But, first of all, I think I watched most of the video. Okay, not most of, mm-hmm. say half of it, just kind of clipped around, skipped around on the rest.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, they're going after, one of the guys is going after, I think the kind of lead guy, Ben Smith, is going after Obama, saying, you didn't do this. The American people did this. You know, he's kind of toggling between saying America got bin Laden and saying the Navy SEALs got bin Laden.
Does that mean that I personally can claim responsibility for getting bin Laden? Because I actually like
right,
that.
No, that's what I'm saying. I mean, it's this kind of weird contradiction in there. It's like, okay, it belongs to all of us, or it belongs to this very select group of people who worked diligently to locate and kill bin Laden. But either way, mm-hmm. Obama doesn't get any credit.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know... But I have to say, I think there's a fair argument to be made, there's a fair criticism to be made about the way the administration has, selectively leaked some of this stuff to make itself look good,
right.
Especially when you look at the effort they put into to clamp down on other kinds of leaks and prosecute leakers, etc. I think there is a real argument there. I think that's a problem. But this clown show is just not it. I mean, I think there was an LA Times story this morning that noted how many of the people associated with the group have themselves been involved with other leaks. One of the guys spent a lot of time on Fox News talking about Valerie Plame, I guess who he had worked with in the CIA, talking about what she did. There was another guy who just last year was part of an NBC documentary called Secrets of SEAL Team 6 that the U.S. military had protested because it revealed secrets of SEAL Team 6. So it's just right out of the gate, these guys have very, very little credibility, just above and beyond the kind of obvious tawdriness of what they're trying to do.
Right, and well, I mean, I guess another way to think about it is that, you know, whereas the official Bush-Cheney campaign in 2004 sort of had a very arm's-length relationship with the Swift voters, right? I mean, there was never, I don't think, any even hint from Bush himself or from Cheney that, that Kerry's service was anything but honorable. And I could be misremembering that. And certainly, you know, it did play out at the convention that, you know, with the Purple Heart badges and so forth, right? But this sort of tack, you know, that Obama was not really responsible, does fit in with how the Romney campaign, what was sort of its very best way of countering any sort of I got Osama bin Laden ad, which is that, well, no, right? I mean, and there's, you know, an obvious truth to that, right? That, no, it was a bunch of people. And, you know, probably, maybe not, and it'll be sort of very interesting to see how this plays out. You know, probably President Romney would have given the same order, even though he kind of said maybe he wouldn't have. But, so, you know, Obama deserves no special credit for this particular achievement, right? And and what this video seems to be saying is that Obama deserves no special credit for this particular achievement and may have even damaged damaged U.S. security through...
No, I mean, that's exactly what it's saying. It's like it's hurting America's security for Obama to talk like this and to, for the administration to make these leaks.
I mean, are we going to get an ad from the... are we going to get sort of any forthright claims from the Obama administration on this point, right? You know, making in as explicit terms as possible that Osama bin Laden was alive in 2000, on January of 2009 and he's no longer alive. Are they going to be super explicit about that, or are they just going to sort of let the atmosphere take care of it?
I don't know of anything, but I'd be surprised if we didn't.
Right.
You know, from an associated group or something like that, or an unaffiliated, quote-unquote, group. But no, I mean, I think this, you know, this is like the original Swift voters in that, I mean, this is the Karl Rove strategy, is go after your opponent's strengths. I mean, as we discussed earlier, you know, Obama's very strong in national security, and the Ryan pick seems to confirm that the Romney camp knows that. But still, these outside groups are going to go after that strength.
All right. Well, do you want to make any embarrassing predictions for the next 3 months that you're sure to be embarrassed by?
I wish I would have thought of that beforehand. I don't really have any just to pop off with. What about you?
Here's my embarrassing prediction. Obama, 271 electoral votes. Exactly 271 electoral votes.
271. I'm going to write
271.
It down.
271. You write it down. I already predicted it on the... well, I also made the embarrassing prediction, and I made this back at the beginning of the year. Bashar Assad's still president of Syria in December 31st. That's going to be really embarrassing for me. So, also tragic for a large number of people. So,
indeed.
Yeah. All right. Well, I mean,
thanks a lot.
Is there anything else we should talk about?
Oh, there's a whole load of things, but we'll have to wait.
All right. Well, Foreign Entanglements viewers, we'll see you next week.
All right. Thanks.